We're very happy and privileged to have with us this morning the UK Member of Parliament, Gareth Thomas, and Minister. Originally a teacher, he was elected to Parliament in 1997, and since 2003 has been the Parliamentary Undersecretary of State of the Department for International Development. His ministerial responsibilities include the UN, conflict and security policy, international trade, regional development banks, civil society and information, and policy areas including HIV/AIDS and global health initiatives. We're highly honored to have Minister Gareth Thomas with us today. Thank you.
Karen, Jean-Francois, ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for the opportunity to come and to join with you. It's both good to be in Paris, but more importantly, it's good to be here at this 37th World Conference of Lung Health, not least because the Union has a very long and very distinguished history of playing a very vital role in improving the health of the world's poor. I wonder if I may to focus on two issues. Firstly, on the issue of tobacco, and secondly, on the issue of tuberculosis. When we think of the burden of disease, it can be very difficult sometimes to see beyond the massive challenges of today in many poor countries, dealing with AIDS, for example, infectious childhood diseases, and the appalling levels of death of women in childbirth. In such environments, the rising burden of non-communicable diseases is too easily sidelined. I believe we ignore this rising burden at our peril. Poor nutrition, for example, diabetes, for example, cardiovascular disease, and cancer are all mounting challenges. In South Asia, for example, the burden of non-communicable diseases is already greater than that of communicable diseases. Within that picture, tobacco is a huge and increasing problem. In 25 years' time, tobacco will be responsible for causing 10 million deaths per year, with 7 million being in the developing world. Indeed, if current tobacco use patterns continue, some 1 billion people will be killed by tobacco use in the 21st century. What we're seeing is that as smoking rates are declining in the West, many tobacco companies are increasingly looking to expand their markets in developing countries. In country after country, we're hearing reports of the tobacco industry lobbying governments with exaggerated reports of the economic contribution they're making. And I believe that together we need to confront that lobbying with accurate data that demonstrates the disease burden and the costs of tobacco use. We know that tobacco companies continue to target young people with images of a glamorous Western lifestyle. We must see that stopping, and tobacco companies beginning to act with real social responsibility. We can see the failure of to practice good public health in practice. In 1990, for example, tobacco-related deaths in India were less than 200,000. The figure is expected, however, to reach a staggering 1.5 million a year by 2020. And tobacco is already a leading cause of death in China. The damage that tobacco results in for families and economies is enormous. Tobacco users suffer repeated sickness and are less productive. The high costs of treatment push families into poverty and are a large drain on a country's health budget. And the poorest households often spend a significant proportion of their income on tobacco. A study in Bangladesh, for example, showed that the money spent daily on tobacco could have added over 500 calories to the diet of children in each family. More than 10 million malnourished people could have an adequate diet if only two-thirds of the money that's spent on tobacco was spent on food instead. Now, the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which many of you would have been very active in lobbying for, is a genuine historic public health achievement, which I think we can be proud of. It clearly sets out the tools that countries can develop to reduce tobacco use and save lives. We do need to see increased taxes on tobacco, strong restrictions being placed on advertising and the promotion of tobacco. We need to see smoking in public places restricted and increased public education on the harmful effects of tobacco. Good quality education programs are going to be particularly crucial. Research from India, for example, shows that smoking prevalence is much greater among the illiterate or those with limited time in school. Now, we know that changing behavior takes time, and countries need to plan and implement a comprehensive approach over time. We need that process to start now. We can't afford to wait until the hospital beds are full of the chronically and terminally ill. Now, we know that progress is possible. The number of smokers in South Africa, for example, has dropped by a third since 1993. That means some 600 million fewer packs of cigarettes being smoked. And it shows the benefit of tough legislation and increasing the cost of smoking, the way in which that has worked and has made a difference. In 2005, we as a department provided just over £1 million to the International Development Research Centre under their Research for International Tobacco Control Programme to fund research in developing countries, by developing countries. It'll help to make the Framework Convention work at the grassroots. Now, we also support tobacco control at country level. In Pakistan, for example, we're funding the Network for Consumer Protection and have done so since 2001. That's enabling them to develop nationwide anti-tobacco policies, advocacy work, consumer education work. There is, too, as many of you will be familiar, an increasing link between tobacco use and tuberculosis. Again, a study in India showed that smokers are much more likely to die of TB than non-smokers. We know that TB is killing some 2 million people a year. We know that there has been progress, but that we're hampered by three key issues. Firstly, weak health systems, then the catastrophic link between HIV and TB, and thirdly, by drug resistance, the recent emergence of extensive drug resistance TB being of great concern. I think that existing TB control strategies need to be overhauled. More money will, of course, help and make an important difference, but money alone is not going to be enough. We need to see more health workers being recruited. We need ethical recruitment practices to prevent the targeting of health workers in developing countries. Now, we are seeing the development of an EU-wide code of conduct on ethical recruitment. We need that urgently. And we need all developed countries to adopt similar ethical recruitment practices. We need better access to medicines, too. Cheaper drugs, of course, but we also need far more stronger systems to ensure that the right drugs are delivered to the right place at the right time. TB and HIV services, too, need to be much better coordinated. In some African countries, as many as 70% of people with TB also have HIV. Yet too many have to attend one clinic for TB treatment and then another clinic for treatment for HIV or for AIDS. Now, that clearly has got to change. We need two more research on TB. New drugs would allow for shorter courses of treatment. A new effective rapid diagnostic test would mean that it would be easier to detect TB. And we need a new vaccine. The TB vaccine we use today was first used in the 1920s. Now, we in the UK, through my department, support TB control through our country programs and through our support for international organizations, through partnerships with the World Health Organization, the Stop TB Partnership, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB and Malaria, and through UNITAID, the new international drug purchase facility. And we're also supporting increasing research. But our major contribution to improving the health of the poor is through our support to governments to improve their ability to deliver basic services, health, of course, but education too, water too, social protection. And we're committed to allocate half of our direct country support to those basic services. Our aid has increased from some £2.1 billion in 1997 to some £5.9 billion in 2005, almost a trebling in our aid budget. And we will meet our target to provide 0.7% of national income as aid by 2013, 2 years ahead of the EU average. We'll meet our target too by making sure as well that that aid is longer term and more predictable, because only then will countries have the confidence that they can scale up health services, recruit additional staff, and be able to pay those staff over the longer term. Ladies and gentlemen, we are making progress in controlling the challenges, the health challenges of today, particularly communicable diseases and childhood illness. Child mortality is falling. In many countries, life expectancy is increasing too. But if we're to defeat TB, then we can't afford to relax. Now is the time to reinforce and accelerate the efforts that we're seeing already. But we also need to make sure that we're ready for the next round of public health challenges in developing countries, that we're addressing those early on. In particular, we need to confront now the challenge that tobacco poses for public health in developing countries. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. This is a challenging issue for all of us, and I think that now Minister Thomas is open to questions from the floor on any of the topics that he's discussed. So please, you can use the microphones that are on each side of the room. Yes, please.
Paul Sommerfeld, Chair of the Stop TB Partnership Advocacy Working Group. Gareth, the major issue that many of us are concerned about here at the moment, those of us who are concerned primarily with tuberculosis, is the impact of extremely resistant tuberculosis. And I think that that has three primary messages. One, the need to increase the robustness of programs on the ground. Two, the need for new tools, which you touched on strongly in your speech just now. And three, the need for increased collaboration at all levels, particularly at field level, between HIV and TB services. And I'm also conscious when you're talking about smoking that on smoking, as on TB, the Department for International Development has a relatively good record. When I have my TB alert hat on and back in England, maybe engage in encouraging you to put more effort into it, still more effort into both those areas. But here I would like to ask you to reflect on, insofar as DFID is a relative angel among donors on TB and smoking, what efforts and how are you making to encourage other countries and other potential donors? We would like to see much more coming from the European Commission. We would like to see much more coming from a number of major EU countries, notably Germany, Spain, Italy, three of the major European economies that so far are spending relatively little, as far as I'm aware, on TB. On smoking, I'm less aware, but I know that I was at a conference of AIDS NGOs in Spain last week, and one of the things that struck me was that they were all smoking like chimneys. and it was the first time for years I had felt uncomfortable about secondary smoking, which has become almost unthinkable in similar gatherings in Britain. So I would really like to say, what are you doing and what can we do to help you in order to persuade others to be good? Thank you.
Sorry. Well, I've never been called an angel before, so and certainly, Paul, I don't think by you before. So thanks very much. We'll use that in our publicity bag in the back in the UK. On what can we do with other donors? Well, we are waiting to see what the European Commission, for example, is going to commit to the next round of Global Fund and financing. The EC has been a key player in helping to mobilise resources for the Global Fund. You'll be familiar with the proportion of Global Fund money that is going into the fight against TB. We want to make sure that more of the Global Fund money is used to help in the recruitment of health workers, in the development of stronger health systems, so that the robust practices at country level that you talk about quite rightly as being needed, we can actually see on the ground. The other thing that I think is important in terms of donors is recognising that donors need to work together more effectively than perhaps we've done in the past to make sure that our efforts are being aligned so that we're having a discussion about where the gaps are in a developing country's response on health, and that countries are taking, developed countries' donor agencies are taking responsibility for filling those gaps, not just doing everything that we think will be of interest to our countries back in our own audiences. So we're putting pressure on the EC. There's more that needs to be done to persuade other donors to contribute on health and TB. That's why I think conferences like this are important. But anything that you can do to... excuse me, I think I must have gone past some smokers on the way in.
In France?
It must have been early on this morning, perhaps in London then. I think networks like this are important because they do provide the opportunity to create debate about which countries could do more. Some of the countries that you have alluded to certainly could have a look at what else they can do, perhaps through the Global Fund or through research programs or the support they give at EC level. So I'd certainly encourage the groups of NGOs that there are to make the representations that they do with added vigour to those countries. And I think all of us need to put to work together to make sure that the EC does come forward with a significant figure for the next round of the Global Fund.
My name is Javed Khan. I'm a professor of respiratory medicine from Pakistan. My question to you is that at the government level, can you take some measures against the multinational tobacco companies, because when they come to the developing country, they forget all rule regulation, they start targeting children, they start organizing musical concert where youth are invited. So can't you take some measures so that multinational tobacco companies follow the same policies as they follow in the developed world and in the developing countries?
My answer to that, Javed, would be to say that actually it is our responsibility, I think, to highlight the damage that tobacco companies can cause or have caused in our own country and to, in a sense, to raise the alarm about the potential damage that tobacco can do in other countries. But at the end of the day, I think it's the responsibility of the developing country themselves to decide what legislation they want to see in their own country. It's not for me to dictate to your government or to another government what they should put in place. I think I have a responsibility to sound the alarm, to, in a sense, point to what good practice there is around the globe. But I think it's for developing countries' own parliaments to pass the laws to put the pressure on in that way. I think otherwise it would be me looking as though I was being a bit colonial. One of the things, for example, that we're doing in Pakistan is to support the Network for Consumer Protection, I think is the organization.
Thank you, Mr. But the thing is they do not even follow the local laws. Take, for example, Pizza Hut is smoke-free in UK, but same Pizza Hut is not smoke-free in Pakistan. McDonald's is smoke-free in UK, but not in Pakistan. So they do not even follow the local laws because there is nobody to challenge them. They are so strong, they've got so much money.
Well, one of the things that we also do, Javed, is to increase the ability of governance, is to tackle issues around governance in developing countries. So helping to build up more effective justice systems, more effective policing systems, to strengthen the ability of departments of health to initiate action. So looking at those governance questions so that big companies can be held to account, that regulation is better. We also provide support in a variety of ways to make that happen. At the end of the day, though, I think it's still got to be your government that prosecutes the multinational company and holds them to account. I think, as I say, I can play a role in raising the alarm. I can play a role in helping to fund research that demonstrates what good practice is. But in the end, the response in Pakistan has got to be led not by me, but it's got to be led by the Pakistan government. And I think, you know, the calls that you make in Pakistan will help to increase the pressure and provide the support to the Pakistani government so that they can do just that.
My name is Bertha from Malawi. My question is, looking at the consequence of a campaign against smoking and tobacco in terms of the livelihoods of smallholder farmers. As we are striving in this campaign, I want to hear from you in terms of how best can we work with other sectors so that in campaigning we should also explore ways of a positive shifting from tobacco farming to other commercial cropping so that we don't live catastrophic or unsustainable livelihoods, which are not sustainable at all even now in countries where the majority are poor and they depend on tobacco farming.
Well, I think you're right to say, in a sense, that we need to recognize that tobacco is grown in many developing countries, and that there needs to be a strategy in place to provide support for the development of alternative crops so that people aren't put out of work. But one of the ways to campaign on that issue, I think, is to highlight the fact that many tobacco farmers find themselves in debt to the tobacco companies, because often what you see in a developing country is a contract system, if you like, between the tobacco company on the one hand and the small farmer on the other, whereby the big tobacco company provides credit in the form of seeds or fertilizer, pesticides, other sorts of technical support, and then in a sense locks that small farmer into continuing to provide into continuing to produce tobacco on their land. So we have to help break through that stranglehold that on occasion companies have with people, develop alternative crops, develop alternative sources of finance like microcredit, better access to finance in that way, and to make sure that in countries' poverty reduction strategies or national development plans, that alternatives to growing tobacco are identified and are being supported by donors and by resources from that developing country government themselves.
Thank you. I'm Linda Carrier-Walker from the International Council of Nurses based in Geneva. My question or and slash comment follows up from the first question, and that is, in your role as a relative angel, I wonder what you could do to prod the rest of the G8 to honor their commitments that they made at Glen Eagles, and which have been absolutely pathetically followed up with, with the exception, of course, of the UK. Those commitments to TB, HIV/AIDS, anti-poverty strategies. And perhaps you could be our Sherpa or shepherd in helping us, you know, with doing some really effective advocacy with the G8 on this issue.
Well, I recognize that things are changing very quickly, and I've gone from being an angel to being a relative angel in just the space of a couple of minutes. Nevertheless, at least angel is still being used as a description. I'm not actually, Linda, as gloomy as you are about where the G8 are. The commitments that were made on debt relief, for example, have been implemented, and potentially $55 billion of debt relief is on the table. The resources have been provided by G8 nations to the World Bank, the African Development Bank, so that that debt relief can be put in place. And we are seeing an increase in resources from G8 countries. We haven't yet got the trade deal, which was one of the key pillars.
but there will be an opportunity after the American midterm elections, we hope, to restart those trade talks. I think it's very important that Germany has put Africa back center stage as part of its next G8 presidency. And to help with the sort of renewed focus that presidency will give to development, my Prime Minister set up an Africa Progress Panel, which is which has on it a whole series of international celebrities, experts, call it what you will, people independent of any government, to chart the progress of the G8 nations in following through on their commitments. And that will provide, in a sense, a very public demand each year for us to follow through on our commitments, to see who is the laggards, and, in a sense, to provide the information to NGOs in each of those countries to use to put pressure on their governments to deliver. But I come back to this point. I think the biggest thing that will help to, in a sense, regalvanize the attention of the international community is the fact that Germany very helpfully has put Africa back center stage for its G8 presidency.
We hope it stays there.
Well, I'm Heidi Marie, who's the whose surname I can't pronounce, but who's the German development minister, has been very, very clear and very, very explicit, as has Angela Merkel, the Prime Minister of Germany, that Africa is one of their cabinet's priorities. We know it's going to be a priority for the German EU presidency as well. What I think all of us have got to do, both those at my level, those within the NGO world, those within the academic or medical world, have got to do, is to seize the opportunity of that focus on Africa to make sure that our voice is heard, and that some of the progress that we've seen, we saw at Gleneagles, is now reinforced and built on.
Solly Bennett, University of Cape Town. I'd like to ask you a tough question, if I may. First of all, may I compliment you on the information you've given us about the foreign aid that will be increased from the UK, and hopefully that will serve as an example to others. And I also heard you say something which addresses some of the defects of foreign aid, which I don't think there's necessarily time to go into, but the way that foreign aid operates is that a very small proportion of it actually translates into aid that's meaningful in terms of development. In recent years, a whole bunch of that aid has been shifted towards humanitarian aid. An extraordinary large percentage is spent on the countries who actually give the aid. It's spent on their own workers supporting the aid programs. But that's one issue. The question that I want to ask you is, has your government ever done the sums regarding the amount of money that flows from developing countries into your country as a result not only of unfair trade rules, and not only from debt repayment, and incidentally, I think that developing countries pay about $350 billion a year in debt interest repayment per year as compared with the $70 or $80 billion in foreign aid that they actually receive. But what about the perpetuation of removal of resources like health professionals and others without even attempting to pay back their education in the countries from which they come? There's an enormous withdrawal of resources from developing countries by developed countries in all sorts of covert ways, which most people don't seem to understand but yet take for granted. The philanthropy is a drop in the ocean. And in my view, we're not going to begin to reverse the situation in developing countries until such time as those in the developed world begin to understand that endless economic growth for themselves, it can't continue to take place at the expense of the very basic necessities for others. Now, is that agenda on the table? Are people discussing those issues? Some of the sums have been done. I'd like to know whether those sums are being discussed at Gleneagles and at other important top places, because without that, I mean, certainly in South Africa at the moment, half of our population is living under pre-industrial Britain conditions, partly due to the way the global economic policies operate. And under those circumstances, controlling tuberculosis and building the infrastructure of healthcare systems is almost impossible. It certainly can't depend on philanthropy.
Well, I agree with you that, in a sense, development cannot be based on philanthropy. I think at the heart of development, there has to be a partnership. And the partnership must be that developing countries do have a responsibility to, in a sense, to reform their trade practices, the way in which we deny access for many developing countries, for example, into the European market. Isn't acceptable and has got to stop, and we've been playing our part in trying to persuade the European Union to do its bit in the World Trade Organization talks to get a genuinely development-friendly trade deal. There's more work to do, and as I say, there are a number of other countries who've got to give some ground, not least the United States. And we hope after next week's elections in the United States that there will be an opportunity to close the gap that there is between each developing country. So, but I come back to this point. There is a partnership role. We need to do more on trade. We need to give more aid and debt relief, and that's what Gleneagles focused on. But the other part of the equation is that there has to be action in the developing country themselves, where developing countries have got to take responsibility for improving their own governance. So, for example, to take perhaps the worst case example of governance in Africa, Zimbabwe, it is not, frankly, the practices of the EU or the other rich nations which has created even worse poverty in Zimbabwe. It is the practice of the government itself. And so there needs to be reform in many developing countries. We are seeing increasing good governance across Africa, and developed countries such as our own need to respond to that. But I come back to this point. It does need to be a partnership. Action by developed countries on the one hand and action within the developing country on the other hand. That was accepted by the Commission for Africa, which was established and which fed into the G8 summit at Gleneagles. And it is that analysis which we need to revive and to move forward on for the German G8 presidency.
My name is Doreen McIntyre from the International NGO Coalition Against Tobacco. I would like, if I may, to revisit the issue which was raised by Dr. Khan right at the start of this question session on the issue of tobacco industry behaviour. I'd like to take slight issue with your response to his question. While I agree entirely that it's not the UK or anybody else's role to set legislation or policy in other countries, I do think it's absolutely our responsibility to take responsibility for our corporate citizens' behaviour overseas. The main instigator of much of the tobacco damage around the world is a company called British American Tobacco. I'm ashamed to be a citizen of that country that has that as one of its corporate citizens. Are you really suggesting that the UK government cannot take some responsibility for the behaviour of its corporate citizens who are running rampage over the developing world with their products, making obscene amounts of profits, much of the taxation from which comes back to the UK?
Well, there is a balance to be struck, and I do think there is an argument to some extent around freedom, which is at the heart of the response I'd give to your question, and that frustrated as I am that frankly that anyone smokes and that there is a demand for cigarettes and other tobacco products. I do think at the end of the day it must be the individual's choice as to whether or not to buy cigarettes or not, and to consume those cigarettes. I think I have a responsibility to try and make sure that as much information about the harmful effects of that tobacco use is made available. If, however, individuals do choose to smoke, I think it is reasonable that companies can seek to provide those products. I want those companies to do that in as responsible a way as is possible. And I think I have a responsibility to try and make sure that developing countries have the resources they need, the access to information that they need, to make sure that companies that are based in the UK, that their activities are well regulated in those developing countries. And that's why I seek to use opportunities like this to sound the alarm about what I think those tobacco companies are up to. It's why we fund research programs around the world, and it's why we do support the efforts in many developing countries to improve the quality of regulation of companies why we seek to enhance the ability of departments of health, departments of education, to educate their citizens, to support their citizens, so that that information, that public education program that is necessary, can be made available. At the end of the day, I do think people have a choice to make. We need to make sure it is as informed a choice as is possible.
Hi, my name is Jody Boffa. I'm from the University of Alberta in Canada. My question is very much similar to what we were just discussing, but perhaps it comes from my naivete or my youth, as was talked about yesterday, but you touched on this idea of the socially responsible tobacco company. And in my opinion, the socially responsible tobacco company would be the one that doesn't exist. What is a socially responsible tobacco company?
Well, let me put it in a different way then. I mean, should we ban try and stop the existence of tobacco companies? No, I don't think we should. And I think it would be, I don't think it's naive to ask the question, but I think it is unrealistic to think that if we were somehow to try and legislate against tobacco companies being in existence, that that would somehow stop the production of tobacco. I do think we have to look at the demand for tobacco and to try and educate people about tobacco use, the addictive nature of it, and to strengthen the ability of countries themselves to regulate the way in which tobacco companies operate. At the end of the day, I do think it is about, in a sense, making sure that countries themselves have the capacity to decide for themselves what companies should operate in their country in what way. It is genuinely not for me, I don't think, to dictate to Pakistan or any other developing country what legislation they should have in place. I do think, and I come back to this point, it is my responsibility to sound the alarm about British companies if they're not behaving properly, about other international companies, and that's what I'm seeking to do.
Just a brief response. As a young person, I find it very scary to see that these things are changing. I'm coming from North America, and I can see that smoking is banned in a lot of places. Advertising is banned in a lot of places, and it's almost becoming just sort of a social pressure to not smoke. While on the other hand, in these low-income countries where we keep discussing this high burden that's going to increase, it seems to be the other way around. And I just think there should be more done to counter that, like it's being done in Western countries. Thank you very much.
Well, as an older, younger person, I sympathize with your frustration, but I would point to you that there are, or I encourage you to say that there are, to recognize that there are also many examples of very positive action in many developing countries. In Pakistan, there is pressure for change. In Bangladesh, there have been a series of steps introduced in legislation. In South Africa, for example, I gave the figures since 1993, 600 million packets of cigarettes, the equivalent of, are not being consumed because of tough legislation and higher taxes. So there is action that is being taken. There are many examples of good practice. What we've got to do is to spread that good practice, and that's why, in a sense, gatherings like this are important. We've got to do more of this.
My turn.
Thank you. You really put the problem of tobacco in perspective with the numbers that you gave. I like billion deaths in 21st century and very rapidly increasing number of deaths in many developing countries, India, Pakistan. Vis-a-vis this magnitude of the problem, what has been the response of the global community? There have been other problems, and at least an initiative has been made. You refer to Global Fund, refer to discussions in G8. Where does tobacco stand? And is there any thought of raising this status, this visibility of tobacco problem at a global level through some forum, some mechanism? And is UK going to take a lead in that?
On TB in, I think it was January this year, a global plan to stop TB was published. And at the heart of that report or that plan was an indication of the scale of additional financing that was necessary. And I think we recognise that if we're to make progress on TB as well as on AIDS and malaria, at the moment the key diseases in many developing countries, then we do need to see more resources committed for health and for research. And that, in a sense, was one of the things that underpinned our approach to the Gleneagles Summit in 2005. That's why we worked as hard as we did to get agreement on debt relief and on aid and on trade, because that will generate the resources for developing countries to improve their own health systems, which at the end of the day is going to be key to moving forward on TB. As I said, the fact that the Germans have prioritised Africa again as part of their GA presidency gives us the opportunity to build on that progress, to look at issues around that financing gap for TB, and hopefully to move forward again. On tobacco, I think there has been quite a bit of discussion internationally. In a sense, one of the reasons for coming today is to say that more international discussion is necessary. And we need to recognise now that for many developing countries, issues around cancer and the diseases that tobacco causes is rising up slowly up the public health agenda for those countries. We need to support them to put in place the right policies and the right responses to those new public health problems. In a sense, point them to the examples of South Africa, what has worked in India and Bangladesh and in Pakistan. And certainly we have a role to play in that process, but we want other countries to play a role in that process and on that agenda too.
Thank you. James Palmer, independent consultant from the U.S. Minister Thomas, I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about some of the parallels and intersections between tobacco and HIV/AIDS over the next 40 to 50 years?
Well, I think the biggest synergy, unfortunately, between TB and tuberculosis is that the incidence of TB is much greater amongst those who smoke. And therefore, in responding to TB, and in responding to tobacco individually, we're also helping to tackle the other problem. So I do think we need to recognise those linkages. Some of those linkages are not well understood, they're not well articulated, and this union, I think, has a key role to play in exploring those linkages further at the international level and putting pressure on politicians to respond to that particular challenge. I hope by coming that I have, in a sense, helped to give you encouragement to that process. I don't think the UK can do it on their own. It does need the medical establishment, and I apologise for describing you as that, to raise the alarm about the linkages between the two, to highlight what further research is necessary, and then to demand that politicians, not only in the UK, but also in other countries, respond.
Thank you. Atul Kapoor with Physicians for a Smoke-Free Canada. I'm not going to call you Angel Minister.
I'm sort of reassured, actually.
And I'm relieved I don't have to. Minister, when we talk about the international tobacco epidemic, and we see that individual countries in the developing world are seeming to reproduce on a much larger scale the epidemic curve that we've seen in North America and Europe. When we see that this is not the result of individual nation-level corporations, but is being a coordinated effort mainly run by three large multinationals, one of whom is resident in your nation. When you say, I think you're being naive, Minister, when you say that the only thrust we can have is individually helping each country and fighting this battle 168 separate times in each separate nation. I think we need to use every measure available to us. And one of those measures that I would urge you to look at is to put pressure on BAT to enact the same corporate code of practice that it's been forced to accept in Europe and in North America on all the other nations where it is ignoring that. I think it's naive to say that each nation has to fight that battle individually to force it to the same standard that it practices in the developed world, and that pressure can be borne on those three multinationals to enact those practices worldwide and to cut off a large part of this epidemic curve that's being reproduced. And I'd urge you to consider that level of action as one of our coordinated responses to tobacco.
Well, I think I said in my speech that tobacco companies do need to act in a socially responsible manner. And I think your point about the code of conduct being observed in other countries as it is in some European countries is a perfectly fair fair point. I am not saying that we need to fight the tobacco epidemic in each individual country on its own exclusively from international efforts. There are many international fora where we need to have the debate about the tobacco epidemic. And, for example, the World Health Assembly is one obvious place for that to happen. We do need to be funding internationally research programs which look at what works in particular countries and helps those countries to put in place the right policies for their people. But at the end of the day, I think, with respect, it is also naive to think that you can fight the tobacco epidemic in a particular country from another country. You do have to support each country develop its own legislation, its own policies to respond to the needs of its citizens in dealing with that tobacco epidemic. So I accept that action needs to take place internationally, but I would encourage you to accept that we need to do even more collectively to support developing countries themselves target and devise their own response to the rising tobacco epidemic that they'll face.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're now going to have to close the session, and the final words will be spoken by John Fossens.
Thank you, Karen. Dear friends of the Union, on behalf of all of us, I would like to acknowledge Thomas Garrett for his very enthusiastic and motivating lecture. His témoignage is important for us, all of us who are engaged in the fight against tobacco, and especially to see what this fight is not only a question of medical and sanitary action, but first of all, a civic responsibility. I am sure that, and the discussion demonstrates it, that we are convinced that in the next future, the major concern of tobacco will be in middle and low-income countries, and that the major risk factor of epidemiologic transition in these countries will be tobacco. And I am convinced that the solution, one great part of this solution, of this problem, will be in a partnership, in a strong partnership between developed and developing countries. And this action will be the future, a great part of the future of the Union. Thank you, Thomas, for to have helped us in this action.